This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Advisory Opinions. I am not David French, but I am Sarah Isger. So this morning, David's wife got a flat tire. No big deal, right? She has her spare. But it turns out last week she had gotten a flat tire as well. So no spare this time around. And David, who is a better husband than probably all of you listening, went out to wait with his wife for the tow truck to come. And he missed our podcast today. The whole thing. The good news was that I didn't need David today because we were talking to Jonathan Ellis, who works in the Solicitor General's office. He's an assistant Solicitor General. He argues cases before the Supreme Court. He was back there when I worked at the Department of Justice. He's an awesome guy. And I was so pumped that he agreed to come on the podcast and just explain a little bit about the 10th Justice and what their office does. So it'll be a really fun conversation. You won't even miss David, except we don't talk about Dune. We don't have any references to Lord of the Rings. The sword doesn't come up. All right. I miss David a little. He'll be back. All right. We're going to welcome to the podcast Jonathan Ellis. Jonathan, I am so thrilled about this. Let me give your little mini bio according to Sarah. So you worked as a computer programmer between undergrad and law school, which is really interesting, an unusual background for a lawyer, actually, although my co-clerk was also a computer programmer. So maybe not as unusual as I think it is anymore. You went to law school at Penn. Then after law school, you clerked on the DC circuit for Ray Randolph, a very popular influential, well-respected judge. You then worked as a Bristow Fellow, and we're going to talk about Bristow Fellowships. That's in the office of the Solicitor General. And then you went on to some other job clerking for some guy named John Roberts, who people on this podcast may or may not have heard of. After that, you worked in private practice for 4 years, and now you are back in the Solicitor General's office as a real deal. Like, you argue cases, you wear the morning coat, you are an assistant Solicitor General.
Assistant to the Solicitor General?
Do they hand you those mugs when you arrive?
Yeah. It's one of the great parts about the job.
Welcome to the podcast. I really appreciate you being here. We talked about the timing for this and decided it made sense to go right after the Supreme Court stopped hearing oral arguments, and their last day of arguments was Monday for the whole term. So that means, you know, you're on summer break, right?
Yeah. In retrospect, probably should have kicked that out a couple more weeks. Not so much. No. I don't know if you want to talk about, we can go into what's the cutoff is, what's looming now. So there's still plenty of work to be done in the office.
Well, I mean, the justices are pretty famous, at least pre-pandemic. You know, Justice Gorsuch teaches in Italy and Padua pretty often. They, you know, are taking European trips, often teaching. But I, you know, that's might be the privilege of being a justice and not so much an assistant to the Solicitor General.
That is correct. That is correct. The summer will slow down a little, but it's not yet.
So the Supreme Court does, unlike, for instance, the Fifth Circuit where I clerked, it does have, though, a seasons to it. So what are the seasons of the Solicitor General's office?
So, you know, it's just alluded, I guess. We do work on the court's calendar for the most part. And so things are busiest in the office when the court is in session, starting in October every year until in the spring. The summer, we're still working on briefs in the Supreme Court, as well as other parts of our job, which we can go into at some point.
Let's go into it. I want to know, what would you say you do here?
So, okay, fair enough. The most high profile thing that we do is brief and argue cases in the Supreme Court. And so the Solicitor General represents the United States and all its agencies, et cetera, before the Supreme Court. That includes cases in which the United States is a party. And so a criminal case or a case challenging a regulation or challenging an act of Congress as unconstitutional. But it also includes participating in cases in which we're not a party, but the federal government has an interest. So think about a private dispute that concerns a federal statute that the federal government, some agency administers, or a constitutional case against a state government that turns on the meaning of a constitutional provision that applies to the federal government too. So that's the biggest, most high profile, and it's a lot of fun part of the job. But we also work on the cert docket, the cert stage work. The court hears something like 70 cases every year on the merits and argues, but they get about 7,000 cert petitions. A lot of those cases are cases in which the federal government is a party, and so we work on the briefs in opposition. To try to prevent the court from hearing those cases in which we won below. We do invitation briefs, which we can talk about, where the court will occasionally look at a cert petition and decide they want to know what the government thinks. So they'll issue a CVSG, it's called, a call for the views of the Solicitor General, and we work on those briefs. And then we work, the SG is actually responsible for overseeing the appellate work of the federal government in all the lower courts of appeals too, which means principally that a federal government cannot, with some exceptions for particular agencies, cannot appeal a decision in which they lost in the lower court without or not appeal without the SG's authorization. And so we work on trying to tee up those decisions for the SG.
And what about the sort of reverse CVSG process? And I'm thinking of the angry cheerleader case, as we call it here, where it's not that the court asks for the views of the Solicitor General, it's that the Solicitor General has views to offer.
Right. So, so we participate in a lot of cases as amicus. And so when the court grants a case in which we're not a party, basically without fail, we take a look at it. To see if it's a case in which the federal government has an interest and wants to participate. So what we'll do is someone will take a look at that at the outset, and then we'll often solicit the views of the divisions in DOJ or the federal agencies that might have an interest in the case, and to see if they think that we should, that the federal government should participate. And if so, what position it to take. We often then meet with the parties. We'll call each of the counsel for each side and say, hey, we're thinking about participating. Do you want to come in and make a pitch? They basically invariably do. And so they'll come and it really turns in, usually about 45 minutes to an hour with each side. And it starts off with a presentation, but it very, very quickly turns into a moot court. And so where the deputy mostly is leading the questioning, but you've got representatives from the office, from around DOJ, and from several federal agencies who get to just pepper the litigant with questions about their position in the case and how it's going to affect, or they think it's going to affect, the federal government, and why the federal government should come in and participate or support one side or the other.
So you have three options at that point. One, decline to get involved. Two, submit a brief. Or three, submit a brief and ask for argument time. What differentiates those last two?
Well, really the court. It's pretty unusual that we would submit a brief and then not ask for argument time. I think if it's a case in which the federal government feels like it has an interest sufficient to make its to file a brief for one side or the other or neither party, which we sometimes do, it's also usually in our interest, almost always in our interest, to ask the court for argument time. And so, you know, we ask for 10 minutes is usually what we ask for in a case like that.
And the court almost always says yes, but not always.
Yeah. So, you know, you can go back and look at the stats. The court, we're sort of unique in that respect that, you know, the court often, almost always, grants our request to participate in argument. But not always. I think they denied our request twice this term, which is the first time in a long time. I think they've denied two of them. But they, you know, just every once in a while deny one of our requests, which, you know, throws things a little bit for a loop around here because we're all trying, the SG is trying to manage everybody's assignments and arguments and that sort of thing. But obviously it's the court's prerogative and we're happy to participate when they let us.
So I found that interesting because on the one hand, one of the trends in the Roberts Court overall has been more expanded argument time, set aside the SG part, just like for those big hit parade cases, longer argument time. Then you have COVID though, where there is no 10-minute argument for the SG's office. You still have to go through all the justices, which means it's 30 minutes minimum at this point, really. So basically everything is expanded argument time. And I'm wondering whether we should put a little asterisk next to the two declined arguments as being kind of COVID specific, because they can't just give you 10 minutes and maybe they don't want 45 minutes of Jonathan time.
I'm sure that they do not. So, you know, that's I hadn't thought about that before. It's true that almost all the COVID arguments have been longer, and I don't think anybody has been kept to 10 minutes during the pandemic or during the telephonic arguments. So maybe that's related. My guess is it's not. My guess is they just looked at the case and decided it was one in which the federal government's interest was not as strong as we thought it was, or maybe they thought we couldn't bring as much unique information to bear. They obviously don't explain these decisions, but you know, maybe it's related to not wanting to hear. It wouldn't have been me, so the joke's on them. They would have got one of my more competent colleagues. But
well, speaking of which, how do you get assigned specific cases? How do you prepare for oral argument, and how many cases a term does an assistant SG expect to argue?
Yeah, so the assignments are handled, ultimately the SG is responsible for assigning cases, briefs, and arguments, although she works pretty closely with the deputies in figuring that out. So each of the deputies in our office has a sort of substantive docket. And so we've got Eric Fagan, is the criminal deputy. He does basically almost all of the criminal cases that come before the court, as well as supervising the criminal appeals in the lower
courts. And he's
courts.
Relatively new to that position. There had been a criminal deputy for a long, long time. And so Eric, people stay in these jobs.
Yeah, they do. It's a good gig. I mean, it's a hard gig. The deputies in our office work amazingly hard. But it's a good gig. It's fun work and it's important work. And yeah, they stay in the role for a really long time.
All right. So you've got Eric, our new criminal deputy.
Yep. And you want me to run through the deputies?
Yeah. Yeah. Why
not? Okay. So Ed Needler, I think he's the longest serving deputy. I'm certain of it.
In history,
I don't know. No, right now. I don't know. I don't know in history, although he's served for long time.
Yeah. I mean, if you've my husband was a Bristow, Needler was there. I mean, there's no, I don't know that written history goes back before the time of Needler.
Yeah, he recently celebrated his 40th anniversary at DOJ. He is amazing institutional knowledge. You know, you'll be chatting about a case and he'll say, "Oh, I think we made this argument in this brief in, you know, 1981. I can't remember the name of the case, but he'll say, don't ask me why I know this, but I think it's in 482 U.S., a decision by O'Connor Look it up.
He also looks like a character, like one of the professors from Harry Potter. He has this amazing beard and these little glasses. And like, if I gave you a lineup of humans and said, pick the longest serving deputy SG, I don't think it'd be 100% would pick Ed Needler.
I think that's right. You get a quill. Like you might know, oh, every time you argue at the court, you know, and Ed has enough to,
to make a new bird. Yeah.
Yeah, he really does. He really does. I think he has the most arguments of any, you know, active advocate before the court right now. It's pretty amazing. So that's Ed. He's got part of the civil docket. Malcolm Stewart has another part of the civil docket. He's been around for some time, although not as he was an assistant before deputy. So sometimes you'll pull a brief from the files and it's got Ed as the deputy and Malcolm as the assistant. You're feeling pretty good about what's in there. And then Curtis Gannon is the newest deputy. He came over from OLC. He was an assistant and then he went to OLC and now he's a deputy. He's got actually a portion of the civil docket and a portion of the criminal docket, a little bit of it. They're doing some shifting around now for that.
I'm going to tell a story about Curtis real quick, because Curtis is falls into that very small group of people. Like, I can only think of one other person right now who falls into this group for me of best humans on the planet. Like, if there's a meteor and we only get to save two people, I already have my votes. And Curtis is one of them. He's a Jones clerk. So he comes from my clerk family. And he is just one of the kindest, most thoughtful, generous, lovely people. And he's fun. And I mean, he's the geekiest, wonderful person. But here's the fun story. So after Comey is fired, Rod kind of goes into this hole in the deputy's office at DOJ those next few days. And he's in the office till like 1 or 2 in the morning. I wait him out and watch him leave most of those nights just to see if he needs anything, wants to tell me what's going on. He does not. He's a hard pass on that. But like, you know, you still like, there's still like a rhythm to what's going on. And then one night he truly like did not leave his office the whole time. I tried waiting him out and couldn't. He just hadn't left. And I was like, I got to go to sleep. This is bonkers. And so I got into work very early the next morning, like probably, 7:30. And I called up to Curtis's office and I said, Curtis, I need to know every way that you can appoint a special counsel under the regs. I need to be able to explain it to reporters. And because we don't know how this is going to get done, we just got to prepare as many ways as possible. I'm coming up in 30 minutes. And like, God bless Curtis. He sat there with all the books opened and tabbed, and like what he's able to do in 30 minutes is a little shocking. And so by the time Rod actually told anyone that we were appointing a special counsel, we were already incredibly well prepared to explain the regulations, the DOJ regulations under which it was done. And the only way that happens is by having someone like Curtis, who like doesn't blink, doesn't ask questions, and already knows exactly where to look and like pulls that book off of his shelf. So I was so thrilled when he moved over to the Solicitor General's office. He's an asset to anyone in any team. So yay, that's true. Curtis. That's
true. Yep. And so in that respect, he fits in very well with all the rest of the deputies who are just amazing lawyers. And you know, it is a benefit to the United States that they are there and that they stick around for so long. And then I guess, so the last deputy, just to round it out right now, is Elizabeth Rehlager, who is the principal deputy and acting Solicitor General, the most recent addition to the office. But she was an assistant before, actually. She was an assistant when I started. So also a return to the office. It's been good to have her back.
Yeah, we don't have a nomination for Solicitor General yet.
No, we don't. No, some eager folks around my office wanting to find out who that might be.
It's you. Congrats.
If someone's taking money on that bet, let me in.
All right. So they're assigning the cases, but are you, you know, are you basically a grab bag? Like you could get criminal or civil. How do the assistants get lined up?
So unlike the deputies, we don't have formal dockets anyways. We are all generalists. And so we just get whatever comes our way. And so, you know, what that means is it's signed largely by, at least the cases, the briefs are assigned largely by availability. Although you do sort of over time develop sort of baby dockets. And so, you know, you do a case about, done a bunch of cases about the patent trial and appellate board. And I've done.
Because you were a computer guy.
No, I think one just landed on my desk one day. And
wow.
And so I keep doing them.
God, who has the FERC baby docket? Ew.
yeah, I don't know, actually. I just finished working on a FERC case, but
or ERISA.
So I'm developing one. Ooh, I have a piece of the ERISA docket. And actually I like it. It's kind of it's fun. I like ERISA. I didn't it before, but now that I've done it, once you like dig in to a case, you know, and you get all wrapped around it, it can all be fun. That's why I'm an appellate lawyer. I like to do, you know, basically anything, and I find most hard legal questions fun once you dig in.
That's sort of the thesis of this whole podcast, I guess, is like, once you dig in, there is nerdery and joy to be found. Okay, so how many cases do you argue a term?
So there's a pretty strong tradition that your first term in the office as an assistant, you get one argument and only one argument. And then after that, the arguments are assigned by seniority. Like most things in the office. And so what that means in practice is that most non-first-year assistants get two every year, and then a handful typically get three. This year's a little bit strange because they had to move a bunch of arguments over from the spring that they got canceled in April or March and April. And so the numbers are pretty low this year, but that's generally what you can expect.
And then the SG and deputies tend to do one per sitting, correct?
No, not one per sitting. The deputies tend to do four.
I didn't mean per term. I meant like per oral argument sitting.
Right. So yeah, but so the deputies only do four. So there are more than four sittings. They typically do about four.
Got it.
Term. The SG will often do one a sitting, but not always. And you know it kind of, some of it depends on, there are cases that are sort of SG cases like that, you know, when the Obamacare case comes up, one of the biggies, it's got to be on the front of the New York Times, you know, you're like, well, that's an SG. And there are cases that are deputy arguments. And then there are cases that are like, obviously assistant arguments.
Not, as we mentioned, FERC, just... ERISA, copyright, patent. The sexy cases.
Although Google v. Oracle, that was a Malcolm argument. Is a biggie.
That was a biggie.
Yeah.
Okay, so it is very famous that the Solicitor General, I mean, speaking of traditions, right? Like, there's a closet full of kind of gross morning suits. like, they're, how to describe it? If you have not been to a wedding where the bride and groom insisted on this sort of thing, this is tails. They are gray pinstriped tails, and the pants are kind of weird, actually, frankly, in my opinion. The suit coats I can kind of get on board with. The pants are very strange to me.
Yeah, it's ridiculous looking outfit. I mean, it's great. I like to do it. I love the tradition. There's really something special about getting to put it on and standing in front of the Supreme Court when we stand. In representing the United States, but the outfit is sort of ridiculous. After my first argument, after my first argument, I was stood on the steps of the court with my wife, you know, and took a picture, and my wife posted it on Facebook, and then she had to like very quickly write in the comments that no, that's not the outfit Jonathan chose as the one he thought he should wear. When he argued before the Supreme Court.
Best represents like, wow. His personality.
yeah.
First of all, so I know, for instance, Rod Rosenstein sort of famously argued a case as the AG or deputy AG sometimes like sort of use their prerogative to argue one of the the lesser SCOTUS cases during their tenure. So Rod Rosenstein did argue a case, and they found him a morning suit that fit. But when you are actually an assistant SG and you're going to do this on the regular, do you use one of the stock morning suits or did you get a bespoke morning suit?
Neither. It turns out that Charles Tuitt, I think is how you say that place. I don't know if I didn't mean to put a plug in, except that it's the only place I know around here where you can buy off the rack morning coat. So I think all of the newest assistants that have joined, at least since I joined, almost all of them bought their morning coat from Charles Tuitt.
And during COVID, we can't see you. The justices can't see you. This is all telephonic. And you're still wearing it.
Yes, we are.
you get tradition. That's crazy, right?
yes, I do. But you know, that's it. When the court announced that they were going to do telephonic arguments, it was a question, but it was resolved. SG Francisco sent out a note and said we are going to continue wearing our morning suits for the arguments, and we have, and we continue to do so.
That's just because Noel Francisco was the confirmed Solicitor General through the Trump administration, and he left right after that, I would assume, like right after that decision, basically.
He left
as is tradition.
July.
Yeah, so yeah. Usually the Solicitor General leaves at the conclusion of the last full Supreme Court term of that presidential term, give or take, and lets their principal deputy as acting Solicitor General for then the next fall through the election. Which is what happened here. Noel looks like he was born in a morning coat to me. Like I thought just the look of Noel really, I mean, he should have been born in the 19th century. It would have like all of it. I was very for it. But that's not how he dresses at all the rest of the time. He was sort of famous for having like a bulky sweater and a cigar out on a bench reading briefs in the dead of winter. Sometimes he would take his convertible over to the mall, have the top down with the heat on, and smoke his cigar and read his briefs over there. It was like a thing that I would tell, you know, the law clerks or interns that if you wander around the building, occasionally you'll just like bump into the Solicitor General. So you never know, and always be polite, especially if that person is stacked with papers and briefs.
Can I tell an embarrassing story about Noel and his, it's been embarrassing to me, not Noel, about his penchant for reading briefs in his convertible. So, I sometimes go over to the mall. It's just across the street from, Main Justice, as you know. And run around the mall, just because I like to run. So I did that. One day when I was when we were back in the office, and I ran all around up around the Capitol and around the Washington Monument and around the Lincoln Memorial, like a 5-mile run. And I got done, and I got back to the office, and I realized that I had the key to my car in my back pocket, and there was a hole in my back pocket, and the key to my car was no longer in my back pocket. So that was a sad discovery. And I just finished a 5-mile run. I'm pretty tired. I went back to the mall to sort of retrace my steps to see if I could find the key to my car. And then for the only time in my life, well, first of all, I got back there, and as I get back to the mall, it begins to pour down.
Perfect.
So now I'm walking around the mall looking for my key in the pouring rain, and I pass one of those ridiculous scooters, and I think to myself, I am super tired, and it is raining, and I need to find this key. And so the only time in my life, I rented one of these scooters. I pulled out my Uber app, you know, and I get the scooter. And so now I'm scooting around the mall in running clothes, soaking, sopping wet, looking for my key, and I can't find it. And I look over, and who do I see sitting in their car, convertible top up, but my boss, Noel Francisco, preparing for argument. And I just, what do you do, right? It just waved and scooted off.
I'm crying. That would happen to me. It's so perfect. And you never found the key.
I did not. No.
Wow. Sad. That is awful. Yeah. DOJ, by the way, has an interior courtyard that is beautiful. It's like the thing I probably miss most about DOJ, because I would spend all my afternoons out there, no matter the heat temperature, reading my stuff. It's also a good way to see the comings and goings of people who use motorcades, by the way. The FBI director comes in through the courtyard, the DAG, the AG, any cabinet official. So, you know, you sort of pick up some information as well. But we're across the street from what I call the Spider Garden, but what is actually called the Sculpture Garden. I call it the Spider Garden because my favorite one there is the giant spider sculpture. So that's also a popular DOJ place where you can occasionally see people walking or having their little walk and talk meetings. There's a gym in the Department of Justice where people run who don't want to lose their keys, but it's in the basement and it's really, really depressing.
I do use the gym. I used to use the gym, but only for, like, you know, the locker rooms. Much, much prefer to run outside, with the unfortunate side effect that you can lose your key in the mall and
all right,
step on a scooter.
Before we leave the morning coats, women wear the morning suit as well.
It's up to the advocate. In fact, nobody in the office, none of the women in the office right now wear a morning coat. SG Kagan did. I think she was very famous for doing that. And I think a few of the assistants, I know a few of the assistant female assistants have since gotten sort of custom morning suits. You can't buy those off the rack from Charles DeWitt. And so I, at the moment, I think none of the females in the office wear
morning coats. Just another example of discrimination in the legal practice that you can't buy off the rack morning coats from a place called Charles DeWitt.
Very narrow discrimination. But yes.
Do you know where when the tradition started?
I don't. No, I probably should.
I mean, it's interesting only because the Department of Justice, as we know it now, didn't really exist in the 19th century. And so it's not actually like this carry-on from, like, oh, the Civil War times. Like, it's almost certainly not. The position of the Solicitor General is, you know, relatively new in the scope of human history, but, like, even in the scope of American government, it's relatively new. So that's interesting. It does remind me of the, you know, one of the great 30 Rock lines, where it's after, you know, Liz Lemon walks in after work and Alec Baldwin is wearing a tux and she's like, "Why are you wearing a tux?" And he goes, "It's after six, Lemon. I'm not a farmer." So maybe that's what's going on. Y'all just want to keep it fancy.
I mean, it's a formal kind of office.
It is a formal office for sure. I would argue that the office of the Solicitor General is more beautiful than the office of the Attorney General or Deputy Attorney General.
I have not spent as much time in those two offices, other offices. Although I think the office of the Solicitor General right now, it used to be the office of the AG. I might be wrong about that, but I think it was at one time. So maybe that explains.
Gosh, all these offices have moved. The office of the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights used to be the office of the FBI director. That's a big deal. And, like, when they shoot movies and stuff, everyone wants to come see that office, which, by the way, like, oddly, my office handles those things. My former office, the Office of Public Affairs. We don't get many movie requests, but when we do, boy, am I there for it.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmerman dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Back to business. So, the Department of Justice is this odd hybrid between political appointees and civil servants. You know, throughout the government, that's true, but most other departments are policymaking. But the Department of Justice has a policy role, but it also has this very non-political role. And there are political SG positions, and the Solicitor General and the Principal Deputy Solicitor General. And then there are civil Solicitor General positions, which you are, your career. Mm-hmm. The Solicitor General is known as the 10th Justice. You know, the sort of point being there are 9 justices to the Supreme Court. They're all a really big deal. And then there's a 10th Justice, and it's the Solicitor General because that person is so trusted and involved in the Supreme Court's docket. I guess I'm just sort of curious how you think the Solicitor General's office maintains credibility through political appointees, through administrations. It's always sort of the 10th Justice, the Solicitor General's office, regardless of who's occupying it.
Yeah. So, I mean, first off, we don't use that term, the 10th Justice, and I'm familiar with it, but it's not as if anybody in the office is, you know, including the SG herself is thinking of herself as the 10th Justice.
No, you have the mug that says assistant to the Solicitor General, and she
correct.
Has the mug that that's says 10th right. Justice.
That's So, but you know, we've already talked about the amicus participation. The court often lets us participate in amicus and calls for the views of the Solicitor General. There are sort of unique perks. You know, there's the office, the Solicitor General actually has an office in the court, which is nice, where we can go and hang out during argument if we're not going to be in the courtroom. They pipe the audio in, we can go there before argument, that sort of thing. And then, you know, the court just recognizes that, you know, that every new SG is introduced to the court. If you look through the pages of the U.S. report, you'll see at the beginning when the new SG is appointed, confirmed. So, you know, to your question though, you know, how does the court, or does the office maintain credibility? I think, you know, in part it is because there's some level of deference given to our office because, you know, in the same coordinate branch of the same government. And so it's not, you know, sort of unusual for the court to look to the representative of the executive branch and give some deference and respect to that person and that person's office. But I think beyond that, I think what we try to do is play it straight with the court. I mean, we do have 2 political appointees, as you point out, but that only 2 of the office. And although, you know, the views of the federal government are before the court change in some cases, some set of cases between administrations, it's not as many as you think. You know, sort of like the public perception of the Supreme Court is that all their decisions are 5-4 and they're these big monster and divisive things. And that's not the truth. And it's similar for the federal government. But the position of the federal government in most cases, it doesn't change drastically, if at all, between administrations. And then regardless of, you know, sort of what our bottom line is, the briefs that we write, we try to be as sort of honest and accurate as we can. And so our briefs have gray covers, unlike, you know, all the other briefs that get filed with the court have these like color-coded rules for the color, and the federal government gets to file all its briefs with gray covers. And it sort of reflects the inside of the brief too, is that we're just here with a straight man. And so if you want to hear and read a straight, unbiased accounting of the facts of a case, pick up the gray brief. That's sort of our goal. And really, I can say when I was clerking, that was I knew that if I wanted to get it here, see what the law was, see what the facts were, I could pick up the gray brief. And we work really hard to protect that that reputation with the court, even though, you know, obviously we have a view, obviously we're advocating for a particular position. We try to do that in a way that sort of puts our cards on the table for the court.
I never thought of the gray color as a metaphor, and I really, really like it. And I will now talk about that constantly and not give you any credit.
Great. I'm sure I stole it from somebody else. All
right. So when you think of the social scene in DC, the most coveted tickets for politicos in the city are at the White House. It's the Easter egg roll. It's the 4th of July and watching the fireworks from the lawn of the White House. But if you're a lawyer, the most coveted ticket all year round is the Christmas party at the Solicitor General's office. There aren't really decorations exactly, and it's mostly hanging out in the big marble hallways that, you know, are there all the time anyway, but it's a bit of a who's who of DC, you know, appellate world. To tell my embarrassing story, Justice Kavanaugh was there after he had been confirmed. And all of the reporters, you know, wanted to meet him. And so I was doing a little intro to Justice Kavanaugh. And I was standing, sort of leaning, whatever, against one of the trash cans. And it's not like one of those like party trash cans. It's like a tin, rounded top, flippy door trash can. And in doing...
I know that trash can.
You know that trash can. In doing so... while leaning and trying to act really nonchalant, like I just, of course, talk to justices all the time to impress my reporters because, you know, them thinking I have access to everyone in the universe is good for me and makes them not try to go get leaks in the department. Anyway, leaning against there, I was holding a phone number and I dropped instead my phone, the phone number and the napkin that I had actually tried to throw away all in the trash can. So while facing Justice Kavanaugh, trying to make conversation, which also, well, I'm trying to dig through the trash can to get my phone back out. And so I'm not paying attention to what I'm saying and basically ask whether he thought that Matt Damon was like good looking enough to play him on Saturday Night Live. It was so awkward, Jonathan. It was really bad. But it raises an important question. Yeah, you guys live a fairly cloistered life in some respects, but nothing compared to the Supreme Court justices. How often are you socializing with, you know, clerks of the court or Supreme Court justices? Or is the Christmas party a true one-off?
It's mostly a one-off. Yeah. I mean, most of interaction with the justices, is at the lectern. We do occasionally run into them at the Christmas party, although to be fair, they are not there to see us. I will occasionally say hello to the justices that I know. But that's about it. And then there's the clerk reunion. So, you know, you mentioned at the top that I clerked for the Chief Justice. And so we pre-COVID, we had annual reunions and get to go and catch up with the chief at those and with our fellow clerks. But that's about it. It's not like we're hanging out at the court with the justices or the clerks or at their home on the weekends. Or something like that.
Where are the chief's clerk reunions?
They're at the court. So we go and they usually have both of the, the East and West conference rooms, not the conference room where the justices meet, but the places where they host gatherings at the court. And we'll get to have a sit down dinner. And the clerks from that year have to put on a skit, which is amusing to the rest of us and terrifying to them. And then we get to catch up with friends and spend a few minutes. The chief is always really good to walk around each of the tables and sit down and catch up with folks there. And so it's a good time.
There's a lot of skitting at the Supreme Court. So you'll have, it's sort of famous, there's like a Thursday happy hour that, you know, chambers will trade off hosting. That's like sort of the main sort of regular socialization. But then at the end of the term, there is a skit. And then, like, I'm just finding out about this, you know, traditional chief skit. So those poor clerks have to do like two skits a year.
They do. Yeah. Yeah. And the happy hours, I don't know if you, there's the actual happy hour, but then, if your chambers is in charge of the happy hour of the week, you also have to do the invitation, which itself can kind of turn into, a skit. Out of respect for my co-clerks, I will not go into great detail about the skits, or the invitations that we did, while I was there. Suffice to say, after one of them, Justice Kagan dropped by my office. Just kind of stuck her head in and said, "Saw your invitation. Keep your day job," which I took to be a compliment because my day job was writing pull memos for her. So that seemed like, you know,
Yeah, I mean, it could have been a really good invitation. And what she was saying was, you were so good at this, but you're like exceptional. Like you're the best who's ever written a pool memo, maybe.
Yeah, it's possible. That's one of the interpretations. Yeah.
In sort of a, you know, a textualist analysis, I think both are equally plausible just on the text, at least.
Which is how Justice Kagan would have me.
That's right. All right. Last question. I published a piece about serial clerks. Did you happen to see my thesis in this?
I have to say that I saw that you published a piece about serial clerks.
Let me give you the Cliff's Notes here. Basically, 1995 was the last time anyone clerked on the court without a previous clerkship under their belt. Since then, you've always had at least one clerkship. It's almost always a circuit court clerkship. There have been, I think, two exceptions where someone came from a state Supreme Court. But what has happened, if you look at like, OT95 to OT06, some people have multiple clerkships. It's pretty rare. If you look at what's happened just in OT16 to now, there have been more multi-clerks, serial clerks heading to the court than from 95 to 2016 combined. It's crazy. And so my thesis was that, first of all, by doing so, you're limiting the number of people who have federal clerkships. That's not an expanding pie. The pie is only so big. And so if someone's taking two of them, and a lot of people are taking two of them, then all of a sudden you have fewer people having that opportunity. And that by doing so, you are further pushing into the likelihood that they're going to come from elite schools, wealthy backgrounds, if they can afford to clerk for that long and move around the country. And most importantly, to my point, it's much harder for women who have to consider, you graduate law school at 25. It's sort of the beginning of your childbearing years. And you've got to think about partnership track and everything else. So I tell you all of that, not to ask about serial clerking. I'm not going to, ask for your opinion on that, but I get a lot of phone calls from people asking whether clerking is worth it. You clerked at the DC Circuit, you clerked at the Supreme Court, you had a Bristow Fellowship, which I hope you'll talk about a little as sort of a quasi clerkship. If y'all are the 10th justice, a Bristow Fellowship is the 10th clerkship as well. Is it worth it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think if you want to do litigation, certainly if you want to do appellate work, but I think if you want to do litigation, it's a pretty easy call if you can make it work financially. You're right that it's not it's not nothing to give up if the alternative is to go work at a law firm, a private law firm where they pay, sort of ridiculous salary sometimes.
Do you know what the new what the starting for a first year lawyer is right now at like the top firms?
No, I don't. I'm sort of terrified to know how much higher it is than my salary.
Yeah, 190.
Yeah. Okay. It's okay. It's all right.
Brush it off, Jonathan. And then of course the bonuses from the Supreme Court, if you're a Supreme Court clerk who goes to a firm, those are at 400 right now.
Yeah, that's gone up a lot, Fat. I mean, that's way higher than, I was paid more than I was worth when I joined Latham, but that's gone up real fast.
Yeah, I think my Supreme Court clerk year from law school, I think it was 250 that year. I mean, so that was 10 years ago. It's doubled, basically.
Yeah. I do think it's worth it. I mean, the experience working for a judge, I did Court of Appeals and Supreme Court, as you noted, and both were amazing experiences. I worked for two really great judges and people, and I learned a ton while I was there. I learned a lot about the law. I learned a lot about how judges reach their decisions, and I learned a ton about how to write, which is what I do for a living. So, you know, I do think it was well worth the investment. You recoup a little bit of it. If you go to a firm, you get paid a bonus. The Supreme Court bonus is as you know, it's very large. But you also get a bonus. Even most firms pay a bonus to any clerk, court of appeals or district court.
Yes, although just to be clear, it's $400,000 if you're coming from the Supreme Court. It's drumroll, $50,000 if you're coming from any other court.
Yeah, but that's not nothing either. That's a good chunk of change. Help pay off your loan. So I mean, you're not going to make it up. The bonus is, I mean, it's not going to make up the money that you lost if you had just gone into private practice. But I do think it's worth a worthwhile investment. And you also, you know, you create bonds with the judges and you create bonds with the clerks that will follow you for the rest of your career and are both, you know, just personally fulfilling, but also professionally helpful.
Talk about your fellowships at the Solicitor General's office.
Yeah, so I did the Bristol Fellowship. As you know, that's a 1-year fellowship for recent law grads. It's usually folks who have just come off of a court of appeals clerkship. We have 5 of those in the office, and they work with us on all the things that I mentioned that we do. So they help research mostly, and help us prepare for oral argument. You know, occasionally, if we can carve off a section of a brief to have a Bristow write a first draft, we'll do that too. But they also work on the appeal authorizations and helping the SG figure out whether to authorize an appeal. And in that process, they play they don't help us. They just play the role of an assistant in that process that works on briefs and opposition. They get to argue a case in the Court of Appeals. That was my first argument, which was an amazing experience. And then, you know, they'll often go from there on to, many of them will go on to clerk for the Supreme Court the following year. We're pulling from basically the same pool that the justices are hiring from. I had a wonderful year doing that. I got to meet a lot of the folks that I now work with. Eric Fagan was an assistant when I was a Bristow. Jeff Wall was an assistant. In fact, Jeff Wall was one of the Bristow coordinators when I was a Bristow. Curtis Gannon was an assistant. And then, you know, Ed Needler was, of course, a deputy, as was Malcolm Stewart. So that was a great fellowship. And I would encourage anybody who's thinking about doing appellate work to take a look at that fellowship. We also have, I'll say I didn't do this fellowship, but I wish I had. I didn't know it existed. So I'll plug it here. A summer fellowship, a summer internship for very recent law grads. So just after you graduate from law school, if you're going on to clerk for a court of appeals judge, usually you start in the fall. And so for that the summer in between, we have something called the Phillips Fellowship. Bristow was the first SG. Phillips was the second SG. And so those folks come in and they actually do very much similar things that the Bristows do insofar in helping us research and prepare for writing briefs. And there are no arguments over the summer, obviously, but they come, they'll go to party meetings that we talked about in where the office is deciding whether to come into a case or what position to take, and sort of just get involved in the office that way. And it's a great, I think it's like a 8-week fellowship or so to get a taste of the office.
Fun fact, Benjamin Helm Bristow is his full name. He was the first Solicitor General. The position was established by Ulysses S. Grant. And then he became Secretary of the Treasury under Grant after that, which is like we don't really think of the Solicitor General now as a stepping stone Treasury Secretary. But that's fun fact. Also, I will note, it's a little hard to tell in his official portrait here whether he is wearing a morning coat. I kind of think he's not. I think he's just wearing a double-breasted coat. And it's definitely not, doesn't look like the, you know, pinstripey one that y'all have. So I don't think this is it. I don't think this is the origin.
No. But if you looked at the portraits, I don't think the SGs wear their morning coats in their portraits. You can go to that one page on the DOJ website where you can look through almost all the portraits. I don't think they're wearing them. So that might not be dispositive.
That's frustrating in its own way, you know, like, why are you not wearing it? That's silly.
Because it looks ridiculous.
I demand the morning coat. If you're going to do this and wear it to arguments, by God, wouldn't it be so much cooler looking if that hallway that lines the outside of the SG's corridor and has all of the portraits of the SG, if everyone were wearing the exact same thing and all that changes over time are the hair and facial hair, fashions, be very cool.
Be cool. Although it's kind of fun to see the collars and various things on those people who are wearing those portraits are interesting in their own right.
All right. With that, Jonathan Ellis, thank you so much. This is a treat to, pull back the curtain on the Solicitor General's office with an assistant to the Solicitor General. I mean, thrilling.
Well, this is fun. Thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
We'll take a quick break to hear from our sponsor today, Aura. Ready to win Mother's Day and cement your reputation as the best gift giver in the family? Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. She'll love looking back on your childhood memories and seeing what you're up to today. Even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep updating mom's frame with new photos, so it's the gift that keeps on giving. And to be clear, every mom in my life has this frame. Every mom I've ever heard of has this frame. This is my go-to gift. My parents love it. I upload photos all the time. I'm just like bored watching TV at the end of the night. I'll hop on the app and put up the photos from the day. It's really easy. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 off, plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's auraframes.com. Use code ADVISORY at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.